Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Alyssa, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is to share stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life, who inspire us to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of ServiceSpace volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest speaker is Mark Stevenson. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let us start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into the space. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today in conversation with Mark Stevenson. As an all-volunteer offering, each Awaken Call is a conversational space that is co-created by many invisible hands. In a few minutes, our moderator, Preeta Bansal, will begin by engaging in an initial dialogue with our speaker, Mark Stevenson. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing. And that's where we invite all of your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org or submit a comment or question via the webcast form if you are listening online via live webcast. Our moderator today is Preeta. Preeta has spent her career at the highest levels of public service, law, the corporate world, and academia, including serving as a senior policy advisor in the Obama White House and as Solicitor General of the State of New York, helping draft the constitutions of Afghanistan and Iraq as a Federal Human Rights Commission chair and U.S. diplomat. I will now have Preeta introduce our guest speaker, Mark Stevenson, and get the ball rolling on this conversation. Preeta, over to you.
Thanks so much, Alyssa. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be in conversation today with Mark Stevenson. Mark is an expert on global trends and innovation. He's also been described as a gifted storyteller, occasional comedy writer, and former stand-up comedian. He's been described as a rare visionary with an ability to express even the most complex scientific problems in terms that are easily understood by a layperson. He's written a couple of really acclaimed books. He's the author of the internationally best-selling An Optimist's Tour of the Future, which has been translated into 10 languages and was described by Wired magazine as a very coherent and entertaining journey through the world of future technology. His latest book is the award-winning We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. And he's on a mission to answer the question, what's next, as he confronts the realities of the future we create for ourselves. From education to energy supply, healthcare to food production, Mark is one of the world's most respected thinkers on the interplay of technology and society. He's worked with a wide range of clients, including government agencies, nonprofits, and corporate and arts organizations, and he helps them adapt their culture and policies to better respond to the questions the future's asking. In his latest book, and we'll talk about this with him briefly, We Do Things Differently, he traveled the globe to meet with innovators who are challenging the status quo and changing the way we relate to the world. To make it more stable, equitable, and humane. He's written for the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, the Guardian, and he's widely respected for his ability to translate complex issues into easily understood concepts. He's also working with Sir Richard Branson on the Virgin Earth Challenge, which is an incentive designed to award scalable and sustainable ways of removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. And he works with a lot of other organizations, including the National Theatre of Scotland, the Future Literacy Hub, Atlas of the Future. He's also started a couple cultural change agencies, one called We Do Things Differently. And he's also the founder of something called the League of Pragmatic Optimists, an organization where people who want to make the world better can meet, generate ideas and projects, get inspiration, and find collaborators. So thank you, Mark, for joining us. He's joining us here from London today.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, we're thrilled to hear all of your creative and energetic thoughts. I want to start a little bit with kind of how you got to where you are. You've described yourself as a reluctant futurist, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that, both the reluctant part and the futurist part.
Sorry,
Mark, I think your audio somehow just got a little mangled.
There's a massive feedback loop coming through. I'm hearing myself back about a second later. Oh, okay, that's brilliant. Are we all good now?
Yeah, much better. Thank you.
Excellent. There we go. Yeah, that's a great way to start talking to a futurist where the technology fails. So to answer your question about how I became a reluctant futurist and why I'm reluctant, it actually started off as a bit of a, I guess not a crisis, but a moment of reckoning in my sort of early 30s, where I had spent my early career doing two things, one trying to be a musician and getting sort of fairly successful at that, and the other being basically, I guess, a brain for hire, thinking about technology, working for corporate clients, and, you know, writing some of the first books on internet commerce and smart cards and things like that. My band, you know, got an album out and a record out, and then it all fell apart, and the drummer went to jail, et cetera, et cetera. I thought it was about time I got myself a proper job, and I went to work in the corporate world, became a director of a financial company, and realized quite soon that I hated that, like, with a passion. For the first 6 months, actually, it was fascinating to learn how that stuff worked, and because those people thought I was very creative, they were very happy to have me there, but there was a moment where my boss, the CEO, the founder of the company, called me in his office and said, Mark, the quality of your work is exemplary, but you just don't care about it, do you? And I said, no, not really. I don't care about this financial transactions organization at all. He said, go and do something you care about. And I was, so he fired me, really, by mutual consent. So I sat down, you know, having had my sort of my musical career sort of implode, and then realizing that I wasn't really cut out necessarily for a job in an office, even if it was at quite a high level. And I sat on my sofa and I asked myself, well, what do I really care about? Because I've got the rest of my life to do something about that. And I realized I cared about a few things. One was combating cynicism. I'm a committed anti-cynic, because I believe that cynicism is just obedience to the status quo. Cynics are kind of, you know, wrap up wisdom. They wrap up apathy as wisdom, and I hate that. And particularly bad in the UK. You come out of the womb in the UK, and they say, "Oh, that's a bad move. It's terrible out here." So I kind of hate that. You know, there's no point in trying because nothing will ever change attitude. You know, because if you think that, well, nothing ever will. The second thing I was worried about was a lack of understanding of systemic complex issues that affect everybody, because I think these things are quite poorly communicated, whether it's climate change or what's happening with genetics or artificial intelligence or what's happening with our soils at the moment. There's these really big systemic things that affect everybody, and they're usually served quite badly by the existing media. So I decided I'm going to spend the rest of my life spreading a meme of what I call pragmatic optimism, which is understanding the reality of a situation, you know, and the complexity of it, helping people understand that, and I mean everybody, you know, and then giving them tools to go and do something about it. Because once you're literate about those problems, you can do something sensible about them. And I want to sort of say, you know, there are these problems, but we can solve them. That's how I started. And the first thing I did as a result of that was become a stand-up comedian. And the reason for that was because, as I kind of hinted at before, you know, when we think about, you know, complex issues was to do with, you know, the retreat of democracy or climate change or artificial intelligence, whatever it is, a lot of the literacy about that stuff is within some quite closed circles. The books about that kind of thing are written by, you know, geeks for geeks. And I say that as one of those geeks. I'm very happy to be one. But, you know, my feeling was, you know, we really need to communicate this to everybody, regardless of their background, regardless of their level of education, regardless of their, you know, current situation, because I believe the more diverse the voices involved in the discussion, the better the solutions will be. In fact, there's plenty of science that backs that up. So I thought stand-up would be absolutely the best way for me to learn how to communicate with everybody rather than just, you know, my intellectual friends over glasses of wine. And so I started touring the UK, doing, you know, comedy clubs with a show and an act that was about, you know, everything from number theory to quantum mechanics to climate change to genetics, seeing if I could take these complex things and tell some truths about them. I'm a huge fan of sort of arts when they're good, and particularly comedy, because the comedy we laugh at the hardest is the truest. It's the stuff that's really true that makes us laugh the most, and it's often the most succinct. And I was always fascinated by the ability of comedians to, for instance, you know, say something about my relationship with my wife that I've been trying to articulate to her for the last 15 years. She's laughing, I'm laughing, and they've done it in two lines, you know, because, you know, and I'm like, how do you take that kind of set of skills and then use it in the service of making the world a better place? And I use comedy a lot now in the boardroom to shorten conversations. You know, Stevie Wonder can, you know, say something fascinating about my relationship that I didn't understand, you know, take me from not understanding it to understanding it 3 minutes later whilst making me dance. You know, and that's a pretty incredible set of skills. So I started sort of doing comedy, and I also set up an agency working in the cultural sector to try and understand how culture worked a bit better and advising cultural organizations on their communications. And as a result of the stand-up, I was kind of offered a book deal, really, because people said, wow, you know, you're really quite good at this, explaining this stuff, and nobody's doing what you do. So I shamelessly stole Bill Bryson's clothes and said, right, I'm going to do a comedy travelogue, but I'm not going to travel around places necessarily. I'm going to travel around ideas. And actually, I did end up traveling around all sorts of interesting places. So I went to dive with the president of the Maldives to talk about climate change. I ended up at Harvard Medical School with George Church, head of genetics. Then I'd be in the Australian outback looking at soil erosion or you know, new systems of agriculture. So the idea was to write this book that kind of looked like a comedy travelogue, this kind of fish out of water comedian wandering around going, what's going on? I don't really know. I'm going to find out. But underneath it all, you kind of got a primer on what I thought were lots of quite important systemic issues.
Wow.
And much to my delight, the book did exactly what I wanted it to, which is it wasn't read by the usual suspects. And actually, it was read by lots of, you know, I guess, geeky kind of people like me who read books about those subjects. But it was also read by stay-at-home parents. It was read by investment managers. It was read by CEOs. It was read by teachers. It was read by this incredibly broad range of people, which is exactly what I wanted it to do. And as a result of that, I started getting these phone calls from all sorts of people saying, you know, this book has changed the way I think about the world. Because it did have quite an optimistic tone to it. In that, you know, as I said, these problems are solvable, and here's how. And then people said, will you come and talk at my school, or will you come and talk at my business, or will you come and talk at my, you know, my professional grouping or whatever. And so I started doing that, and then they said, wow, you know, will you stay? And will you advise us on how we handle some of these questions? And so slowly over a period of time, I sort of morphed into this guy who now does all sorts of strange strategy work for organizations as diverse as, you know, the GSMA, which represents the mobile phone industry worldwide, to Médecins Sans Frontières, to the National Theatre in Scotland. So that's the short version of it. And then I wrote the second book, which is all about systems change, and that's given me a whole new set of things to talk about and advise people on and helping them shift systems. But the reluctance comes from the fact that I never called myself a futurist. Everybody else started calling me it. And actually, everybody's a futurist. I think it's Martin Seligman says, we shouldn't be called Homo sapiens, the wise ape. We should be called Homo prospectus, the ape that thinks about the future. Because human beings are pretty much the only species that really thinks about the future in the long term and can think sort of, you know, 20 or 30 years ahead. So I never call myself a futurist. And also, futurism is very much associated with prediction, which kind of goes against my core belief, because I don't believe that the future is predictable. You know, we know what's going to happen. I believe we make it. I believe the human race is a co-inspirational network. So I'm more interested in saying, look, these are the questions the future is asking us. I can't predict what's going to happen in the future because it all depends on what we do. And I see my job as trying to help people answer those questions, whether that's using their finances or their skills, whatever, to make the world more sustainable, more equitable, humane, and just. Sorry, that was quite a long answer to quite a short question.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. There's so much I want to unpack in that. I want to spend a little time talking to you about like what are the big trends that concern you most. But before we go there, because I imagine that can take a chunk of time, I'm curious. You know, you talked about your background as a musician, so and then also kind of you were working as a brain for hire, I think is how you described it, thinking about big topics. But so how did you get focused on these big systemic issues? You said there's a lack of understanding about the systemic issues that affect all of us. How did you start unraveling that and putting your mind around that? Most young people in their early 30s or so usually aren't thinking about, you know, at that scale.
Well, I was lucky in the fact that at that period, because of being in a band, which I had been for the last sort of 10 years, is not very good for relationships. In that, because you're touring or you're busy or you're obsessed with the band and you're not really sort of committed particularly to a long-term thing. So I was lucky in the fact that I wasn't married, I didn't have kids, I didn't have any of those things sort of crowding, you know, my mind. So I could think quite freely. But I've always been a kind of, I guess, a voracious reader of, you know, intellectual, curious stuff. And therefore, I'd always known about climate change. I was writing books about the internet before most people kind of really understood what it was. I guess it's just a kind of, I'm that kind of geeky guy who's, likes a knotty, thorny intellectual challenge or something that's, curious to me. So yeah, that's how I got to it. And actually, to be honest, I don't think you don't have to dig very deep to find this stuff. You know, it's not like climate change is hiding in the corner. It's not like the retreat of democracy is hiding. Itself. It's not like the erosion of the soils is hard to find out about. I think some people don't want to think about those things because it's emotionally convenient not to. But one of the things I say to quite a lot of my clients is, look, taking the future seriously is going to cost some people their jobs and be uncomfortable, but not taking it seriously is going to cost everybody their jobs and be far more uncomfortable.
That's great. So then you start work. I mean, because I assume your background in part is music and comedy and all that. Your ability to translate like these very complex and big systemic issues to an ordinary audience. How did you? It sounds like you said you also kind of studied culture a little bit. Was that something that just came naturally to you, or is that something you've worked at?
I think it's something I've worked at. I mean, the thing about being a musician, and I've always been fascinated by really great pop music. Because I think that succinctness to tell the truth and move people is interesting, and the great lyrics and the great songs that kind of we remember. And so I studied long and hard pop songwriting, which is actually a way, when at its best, of taking complex emotions and or ideas and distilling them into something sing-on that's true that you feel. So I'd always done that, and then stand-up was the next level up, because you're not trying to get people to sing along something for 3 minutes. You may have 40 or 45 minutes to explore all sorts of issues. And you're always looking for the thing that will connect to the audience. I mean, the problem I find with quite a lot of people trying to communicate, the risk of artificial intelligence, for instance, or whatever, is they kind of always start from the position of, I have some knowledge, I'm going to give it to you. So it's quite, the audience is quite passive, or they're kind of being talked at, and a lot of books in this area kind of like somebody's got a theory, they're a professor from Harvard or MIT, and they say, well, I know what I know and I'm going to tell you about it. Whereas I like to start from the position of the reader and kind of go, well, what questions are they asking, what don't they know? And so I'm sort of kind of almost in some ways kind of keep myself willfully stupid in ignorant in a way, and then kind of slowly unpack and explore that issue kind of along with my reader and wonder what would they be asking at this point. And the person I always think about is my mother. My mother is an intelligent woman, but she's not necessarily that bothered about nanotechnology. She's more interested in Agatha Christie novels. So I'm always thinking, what would be a way to describe this that would make my mum put down her Agatha Christie novel, look up and go, that's interesting, tell me more.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And just in the realm of books, like, are there authors that, apart from yourself and your books, are there books you think that have done this successfully in terms of transmitting complex ideas in simple ways?
Yeah, I think we're certainly getting better at that, and I think there are some really great writers. Oh God, of course, the name of the guy I'm thinking of now gone right out of my head. The guy who wrote Where Good Ideas Come From. What's his name? I'll look it up in a minute. My friend Michael Brooks in the UK wrote a brilliant book called 13 Ideas, 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, which is a brilliant way of describing all the intricacies of how science works or doesn't work. And then he wrote another book called Free Radicals, which is about how science works, but it was through characters and stories. You've got Simon Singh, who's fantastic at taking mathematical concepts and making them understandable. I mean, there are quite a lot of those writers out there. I have to say, when I started writing books, I mean, I've only written two, I'm working on a third at the moment, but when I started it, I would say the standard was quite low. But I think it's getting much, much, much better now.
Great. So what are the big issues, the big systemic issues and trends that are kind of motivating you and keeping you up at night?
There we go. Stephen Johnson, that's the guy that I wanted to mention. Stephen Johnson is the guy who wrote Where Good Ideas Come From. I think he's a brilliant writer. So the big issues that are keeping me up are, of course, climate change. There is soil erosion. There is sea level rise, because we already have at least probably the best part of 2 meters of sea level rise already baked into the system, because the sea has been absorbing 90% of the heat from climate change, and it's going to give it back at some point, even if we stop emitting carbon tomorrow. I'm interested in the energy transition, in particular, how we move from a centralized, controllable by a few powerful people energy system to a much more democratized system that will give power to the people. I'm interested very much in democratizing technologies. I'm worried about the retreat of democracy, and I mean that in the fact that democracy isn't democracy anymore, and that's one of the reasons it's failing, because it isn't democratized things. You know, we think about, you know, America or the UK sort of being these sort of grand democracies, but they're not democracies anymore, because they don't democratize health, wealth, education, opportunity, and they're very much influenced by money. And I'm interested in new systems of democracy that can actually really bring power back to the people and how those work, and it's something I covered in the last book. Automation, of course, and what that, you know, the promise and the threat that brings to people about what we do with the economy when robots and machines are doing a lot of the jobs that currently humans do. Education is a huge issue, because I think in most countries the education system still seems to think it's 1960 and is still working along, you know, lines that a teacher from 50 or 60 years ago would easily have recognized, which is kind of tragic when you think about, you know, the fact we've got to educate our children into a world that's going to be vastly different with these huge systemic challenges. So I think that's, you know, there's probably another 5 or 10, but I'll stop there before I depress everybody.
Yeah, so how do you, all right, so these are huge issues. How do you get the average person to feel a role, a sense of agency in addressing or thinking about any of this? It's one thing to kind of know that these are huge issues. It's another to feel like I, as an individual, can do much about it.
Well, that is probably the core question. And I guess that's probably right at the heart of my work, of how do we get people to be involved. So the first thing you do, and I do a lot, I guess, is you inspire. And inspire people to the belief that it's actually worth doing something. So a lot of people just think, well, there's no point in doing anything because everything is lost. And if they've got that mindset, then nothing, they're not going to do anything. I was with a bunch of very rich investors who had that attitude a few years ago at a kind of a secret conference, and somebody kind of summed up the conference's mood as, we're all doomed, let's get to the sweet trolley. You know, and that's not a very productive way of thinking. So you have to get people to the fact that actually we're not all doomed, but you've got something to do. Cool. So first is the inspiration, and then you have to meet them where they are. So it's not about saying you know, you have to go and solve this whole huge problem yourself because, you know, you can't. But you can do what you can where you are, and there are things you can do, like move over to a renewable energy supplier is a really simple thing you can do, for instance, in the UK. I think it was Alice Walker, the great American novelist who wrote, you know, fabulous books like The Color Purple, and said, you know, the easiest way, the simplest way people give up their power is by believing they don't have any. And as Gandhi famously said, you know, what you do will be insignificant, but it's really important that you do it. But what's one of the reasons I kind of set up the League of Pragmatic Optimists, which is currently in stealth mode at the moment because we ran out of money. But the idea was that we create a club where people could come together to find the thing they were interested in and then kind of get involved as a citizen. I kind of like the gateway drug for doing good. But also you kind of meet people where they are. So there's a model of change that most organizations adopt, which is they say, okay, we've got to change the priorities, we've got to change the way things are, you know, governed, we've got to come up with new policies and whatever. So we've changed our priorities, so what are the projects we need to get out there to do this thing? And then, okay, once you've got the projects, okay, what assets do we need to bring to bear, whether it's money or people or whatever? Okay, well, now we have the assets that we understand. What is the information we need to get out there to people? And then finally, what's the story we're going to tell them to get them engaged with this? And that never works. And it never works because you're trying to throw a change agenda into a population of people that's not ready for it. And so in a lot of my work, when it comes to systems change, you find that what you have to do is start off by creating the soil in which change can happen, which is actually creating coherent communities who actually feel agency amongst themselves. So actually you start off by creating places where people can just share their stories. And when they share their stories, then they'll happily share information. And when they happily share information, then they'll share assets. And when they'll share assets, then they'll get involved in projects. And when they've got involved in projects that are local, they'll start to question priorities and governance and stuff. So it's kind of, but you have to kind of go up and down at the same time. They're doing some really interesting stuff in Guernsey at the moment about creating a much more coherent society. And the first thing they did down there was create more coffee shops. So just creating spaces for people to get to know each other and share their stories and trust each other. Because you can't get anybody to change unless they're already a coherent community that feels that between them they've got something worth changing.
So you're describing almost exactly the service-based model, which is creating spaces for people to just share stories and then come together and then eventually let an agenda emerge rather than kind of throwing an agenda at people.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't know that was the service-based model, but it's kind of obvious when you see it, but it's interesting how many, you know, investors, NGOs, government departments just don't get that, and that's why so much money and heat is wasted in trying to do good things that often fail.
Yeah, so I feel like we should take maybe a concrete example, on one of the issues, like for example, the retreat of democracy, which at least in America right now is a very big issue, and I imagine in the UK as well. And maybe just talk about like what would that mean? So what would this new, this different model, how would that begin to address people?
Well, there's lots of people experimenting with new ideas of how democracy work. But in the second book, we do things differently. I thought, well, where is there a model of a democracy that democratizes things? Mm-hmm. And I searched long and hard to find something that I thought, you know, looked like proper systemic change in the way that governance is done in the relationship between the state and the people. Because in all the other areas I was looking at, I could find quite a few examples. I mean, I'm not saying there were hundreds of them, but it was always like I had to choose between three or four to decide what to put in the book. But when it came to democracy, I found it very hard to find something that I thought was convincing, sustainable, systemic. And eventually what I found, and I'm sure many of your listeners will already know about this, is the concept of participatory budgeting. Mm-hmm. Participatory budgeting, for those that don't know, is this really simple idea where, you know, the government of the city or a town at the moment, no nation is really doing it properly yet, but, you know, certainly some very large cities have done it. The government says, okay, citizens, we've collected your taxes. How would you like to spend them? And depending on which city it is, they'll put, you know, differing amounts of money on the table. What's interesting is when a city does this for 1 or 2 years, nothing changes. People are still pretty cynical about it because of this decline in trust we have in government. And you know, it just doesn't catch. But if you do it for 20 years, it starts to become part of the culture. of a place. And the World Bank has done these rather brilliant longitudinal studies of cities, particularly in Brazil, where this idea started, comparing cities of, that are very similar, ones that had participatory budgeting and ones that haven't. And a number of really interesting lessons come out. Well, the first is that participatory budgeting is good for everybody, like rich, poor, government, citizen. The city starts to run smoother. Poverty declines. People are happy to spend, pay their taxes. Tax receipts go up in times of recession even. Corruption goes down. Public projects get are much more efficient. And politicians that support a participatory approach, they have a 10-point upswing in the polls over politicians that don't. So it even makes politicians popular. So this to me is a very interesting model. And it also turns out that the more marginalized the people involved in the decision-making about the budget, the better the result is for everybody, because it turns out that the most marginalized and the poorest, they really make very smart decisions about how money should be spent. So it's much more complex because you have to involve a lot more people, but actually it turns out to be much more efficient, because at the end of it, whilst the process itself may look a lot more inefficient because, most budgets are decided by, a few people sitting in City Hall, whereas now you're having to involve, a large section of the populace. So that does cost more money. It is a bit more complex, but the benefits in terms of tax receipts going up, efficiency of the state, the quality of everything from child mortality to education to sanitation all going up. This all has this massive economic boon for the town. Everybody gets happier. So, that's a really good example of, going to people where they are, building a community slowly over time that says, let's start sharing our stories of the things we need. Okay, let's start putting some information about what we would need to do to solve those problems. Okay, now the government comes along and says, well, I'm going to put some assets on the table, which is the money, and then projects get built and the community gets involved, and then the community starts to sort of question the priorities of how the government is run, and they do that, and to a much better degree than is the current system. I'm not saying it's perfect. There are lots of problems, with all systems of governance and trying to spend money. There's always going to be niggles and wriggles. But it's far superior to the system we have at the moment, whereas you vote for, somebody who doesn't represent you but replaces you, a system of democracy that's really about getting as many people as from your side into one room as possible so they can argue against the other side, and there's no nuance to it, and it's very divisive and partisan and drives people apart. I mean, one of the things I learned, continually in my work is that people divided by politics are very soon brought together around projects. I mean, you look at America at the moment, in the UK, we've got this huge kind of like partisan divides of, good citizens being horrible about each other, because, they support one side or the other. But if you wander in and go, would you like to build a bridge or a school, or where should we put the street lighting? Well, that politics disappears and people start having nuanced and interesting discussions about how to make their communities better. So, that's my big example. Sorry, not a long answer.
No, that's fascinating. I mean, it raises for me the question of, so what is the role of the big picture thinking in all of this? I mean, I've certainly seen examples of that kind of bringing people together, inspiring them, having them share stories, and coming together around their own common agendas. But I'm curious because, I tend to think in terms of big systems thought, but I've often found that to be a hindrance to bringing them together and focusing just on their individual stories, their having them kind of come up with their own agenda, and so I'm just curious, like how do you bring the two together, the big picture systems thinking, where people do sometimes kind of operate more from their head than from their heart, and it does get them into kind of a headspace versus the very small coming together, creating space, sharing stories, which I think works so well because it encourages people to tap into their heart space.
I kind of think they're indivisible. The local is the big picture in a way. So if you take energy, for instance, I'm a big fan of democratizing energy. So there's there are towns, for instance, now in the middle of Texas. There's hundreds of towns in America called Georgetown, but there's one particularly in central Texas that has moved over to renewables this year. It's one of the reddest towns in America, by the way. It's one of the most conservative towns in America. I think pretty much everybody voted for Trump. So it's not a town where something like climate change would be high on the agenda. But what they've realized is that it's just cheaper to use oil, to wind and solar than it is to use oil, even though they're right next to the oil fields, and lots of other towns are following suit. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that you know, you can tap into an agenda of cleaner air, cleaner water, a boosted economy. These are all big picture things. It's just which big picture. And the other thing that distributed energy system provides is a lot more energy security, and national security, because you know it's very easy to take out a few big power plants, but it's very hard to take out a distributed system. And this is one of the things that we'll do for Vladimir Putin in the end, because he won't be able to control so much so many resources when actually we're all generating our own energy, because most of his power comes from the oil and gas system that he's kind of embedded with. You know, he can't afford to be hacking other nations or having adventures in the Crimea when we're all generating our own energy. So, those are all big picture things you can say to people. Also say, by the way, it's going to be cheaper. So you kind of link the two.
Yeah, interesting. So, I totally agree with you. The local is the big. The question, I guess, that I was trying to get at is, does it help to talk about the big in that context? Because sometimes, if you talk about it in the context of, climate change or, renewable energy, whatever, you often get into political debates when, in fact, if you just focus on, what's cheaper for us as a community, you might actually get a better result than talking about the big, big issues.
Yeah, so when I was a stand-up comedian, and when I started out, so for the first few months on the circuit, you're given the job of driver as well as act in the middle. So every comedy show has three acts. A headline act is usually somebody pretty famous and pretty good and is well known and is drawing in the crowds. A startup act who is experienced and knows how to get the crowd going, and they're put there A, so they have a nice crowd warmed up for them, but also if they stink, it doesn't matter too much because everybody knows the funny guy or gal is coming afterwards. Okay. And then that middle guy is also the driver. So they get to pick up the two acts, drive them to wherever they've got to do the gig, which could be hundreds of miles, and drive back, which also means they can't have a drink after the gig, which is very upsetting. But the big advantage of being that guy, as I was for the first sort of 6 months, was you get 2 or 3 hours sometimes in a car with people doing the same job that you're trying to do, and they do it better than you. And therefore you get a lot of advice, because you've got trapped in the car, and there's nothing that comedians love more than talking about themselves and their art, believe me. But I remember of all those conversations, I had hours and hours of conversations about the craft of comedy. The best piece of advice I ever got was an observation from a famous comedian here, and he said to me, look, a competent comedian will say what he wants to say, and the audience will laugh. So a really good comedian will say what the audience wants to hear, and they will laugh. He says, but a brilliant comedian will say what he wants to say in the way the audience wants to hear it, and they'll laugh. And that was, so for me, it's always like, okay, what is it I want to say about climate change, social justice, democracy, whatever? What is the way they need to hear this? So if I walk into I was in Goldman Sachs this week, for instance, and I left them slightly ashen-faced, but I wanted to talk about sustainability. So I don't necessarily go in there and say you've got to worry about the Arctic, or you've got to worry about polar bears or whatever, because you just get thrown out. But when I wander in and say, look, the UN has these 17 sustainable development goals, and every nation on the planet is going to be reporting back on those and advancing those to one degree or another in their legislation. If I was a long-term investor, where would I be putting my money? Because if I'm to tell you that every nation is going to be increasingly advocating and moving forward on these, then maybe you should be investing in organizations that are advancing the sustainable development goals rather than fossil fuel companies. By the way, the fossil fuel companies are valued at $22 trillion. If we burn their reserves on which they are valued, then there is no market left because we're all dead, because we'll have destroyed the human race. So there's a massive carbon bubble coming, and you probably should get out of that right now. So it's saying what I want to say, which is about climate change and improving the world, but saying it in a way that they can hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating. Echo suddenly came up.
Oh, it's upsetting when that happens.
Are you hearing my echo?
I'm not hearing your echo. I'm just hearing you. Are you hearing your echo?
Okay, then I'll put it on. So the question I have there
is, for an individual in the UK
that wants to develop a retreat democracy. For example, what would be your advice in terms of doing something actionable that would actually help it fall?
I didn't quite get all of that, but I think the question was, if there's somebody who's worried about the retreat democracy in the UK, what advice should I give them about doing something actionable?
Yes.
So if that is the question, I'll try and answer it. So the first thing I think to do is be optimistic that things can change. And the second thing to do is, what I found in my life is that politicians generally don't lead. What they do is they follow what's already happening on the ground. So rather than thinking about necessarily hassling democracy, just go and say, what is it we want to do here? Do we want a better education in our town? Do we want cheaper energy? Do we want better healthcare? Okay, the most democratic thing I can go and do is go and make that happen. And you'll find out that towns that have done that, there's a town here in the UK called Frome, for instance, where they just kind of decided, you know, we're going to actually not deal with politics in the way that you think politics is done or democracy is done. We're just going to, as citizens, start making the place better. And now that entire town, all of its councillors, the entire local government, is made up of independents. There isn't anybody from a recognisable political party. It's run by the people for the people. So I think the best way you can think about, you know, improving democracy is go and do something that democratises. Don't necessarily think about dealing with, you know, the local party. Think about going, well, how can I make healthcare more accessible to more people? How can I get, you know, some more people involved in doing that? You know, and pulling together people that, you know, do democratization. You know, again, to quote the famous Gandhi quote, "Be the change you want to see in the world." I think there's this, you know, the current version of democracy we have is very passive, where you think you can influence it by influencing political parties, but actually, the most radical thing you can do in terms of democracy is to democratize opportunity in your neighborhood. And it's something, for instance, I've seen in Detroit when I was there, you know, looking at the urban farming revolution that's helping the citizens reclaim their own city, because they've got together as a community to say, we're gonna do this together. And that's the most democratic thing you can do.
Great. I'm still echoing. Alyssa, maybe you can hear me?
Yep.
Great. Thank you, Mark. This has been a really fascinating conversation.
And I wanted to follow up on the quote that you had about comedians. And the differences between a competent, great, and brilliant comedian.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like I'm echoing as well.
It's Vladimir Putin. He's hacking us.
There's the comedian. Apologies for the technical difficulty. We're going to try and see if we can get this sorted.
Perhaps you and I can dial back in.
Yes, that makes sense. In the meantime, Mark, we'll be back in a second. But what I was going to ask about was another kind of example of taking the time to figure out a way to say it in a way that people could hear it.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch the question.
Is there something you wanted to say but struggled to find a way to say it in a way that people could hear it?
Oh yeah,
Because it's particular to you and your voice.
No, I think every you come up with that at every juncture that it's hard to do because the person you're saying it to will change. So, you know, if I want to talk about climate change to, you know, an 8-year-old school student, or I want to talk about it to a government minister, or I want to talk about it to an investor, or I want to talk to a business owner, or I want to talk about it to, you know, the guy I met in the pub, you have to find a new way of communicating them. And I guess that requires an extreme amount of listening because you have to understand where they are before you can begin to communicate with them. So I think, you know, it's every one of these is difficult. And that's why, you know, that some comedians, you know, are fantastic and some comedians aren't, you know. The thing that I always try to remember when I'm trying to communicate with people is something I kind of learned from Richard Pryor, not learned it from him directly, of course, but just studying his work, was that whenever he was trying to communicate something, he would always make himself the butt of the joke. He would always make himself the idiot. He'd always be the person who was struggling. You know, so if he was going to do a joke about drugs or stupidity or, you know, being in a bad relationship, you'd notice that he always made himself the butt of the joke. It was never about anybody else. And so I think when you're trying to communicate anything, you kind of have to put yourself in that. I really don't know how to, you know, I'm not coming here, you know, as the guy who knows. I'm coming here as the guy who kind of is a bit of an idiot, but would like to talk to you about this thing, and I don't understand how to talk to you, so let's have a chat about that. So I think it's a certain amount of humility that's needed all the time. But no, every conversation is on that. That's, you know, I spend hours sitting in rooms with, you know, friends of mine at Atlas of the Future, thinking, oh, how are we going to communicate this thing to these people over here? And are we even getting it right? And then listening to the feedback all the time. So you know, there every issue is almost impossible to communicate. But that's where the skill and the diligence comes in. You know, it took me 4 years to write my second book and 4 years to write my first, because of that very problem.
Okay. I'm still echoing.
All right.
Let me try and plow through this. The question I have. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm curious. You focus a lot on technology. What is the role of wisdom, consciousness, and spirituality, do you think, in shaping the future?
Well, you know, thanks for the easy question. This is my take on it. When people are talking about spirituality, and what I hear is what they're talking about is connectedness to something bigger than themselves, an idea that's larger than themselves. And so for me, I feel that connectedness actually comes from coherent communities best. I'm not against a level of connectedness coming from, you know, a religious idea, and this is actually something that my mother benefits from enormously. But for me, you know, when I find myself feeling the most, I don't know, elated, euphoric, in tune with, I don't know, a higher purpose, it's when I'm inside or working with a really well-functioning community full of optimism and hope and agency. And so for me, the ultimate spirituality is capturing and harnessing the spirit of people to do good collectively. That's kind of how I view it. And, you know, I mean, I've been asked to work with all sorts of, you know, faith groups and political groups and all sorts. And so, you know, it's working out how to take what is their bigger than me thing, and again, use that in the service of trying to solve some of our big challenges. I try to remain completely apolitical and completely a-religious, because I think as soon as you get into any endorsement of one spiritual view or another, or one political view or another, you're instantly put up a barrier to working with somebody else. So, for instance, I've been asked by Muslim groups, Christian groups, humanist groups here in the UK to sort of endorse them or be a supporter. And whilst I had, you know, a lot of affection for all of those groups, it was like, I can't, you know. So my spiritualism, if there is one, comes from the connecting of people together and seeing them build things together. And that's the connectedness I strive for. I don't know if that really answers your question, but that's kind of how I feel about it.
Great. When you're working with major corporations and some of the groups that you're advising, what do you think is their higher purpose or consciousness as being something bigger than themselves? Do you think they're willing to create meaningful change in democratization?
Yes and no, and I think we're in a big transition there. So one of the things you realize about corporations is they're made up of people, but you get people doing strange and bad things because of the system that they're in. There's the famous quote I'm sure you're well aware of and many of your listeners will be, which is "Culture Eats Strategy for Breakfast" by Peter Drucker, the great business thinker. But, you know, one of the things that's broken along with, you know, the fact that we have, you know, say, mass inequality, climate change, soil erosion, is the world of work. So Gallup do this survey every 2 years, and they go around the entire world and they speak to, you know, employees in all sizes of company, big and large, and worldwide on average they find that unengaged employees outnumber engaged employees 2-to-1 often, and in some countries, you know, employee disengagement is about 85%. I think in the States at the moment it's running about 75%. So 3 out of 4 people just don't like their job. Okay, so that's very, very bad. And it's because I think that people are now, you know, at all levels, they realize their wage is as much bribery as it is reward. You're having to forget the fact that the money is flowing to some shareholders distantly, the planet is getting destroyed, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, I can't bear it anymore. Now, it's a very, very bad situation to be in. Forward-thinking companies are beginning to really take this seriously. They realize that companies driven by purpose, by higher purpose, A, are nicer places to work. But B, there's now stacks of research that backs this up. They actually outperform the market in the long run in terms of accounting performance and stock market performance as well. You know, it doesn't really matter which think tank you go to, left or right, but this is pretty much the results they come up with. And I prefer my research in the National Bureau of Economic Research because they're kind of nonpartisan. But, you know, there's, you know, actually having a purpose-driven company that speaks to a higher purpose is actually really good for business. And now the investors are coming on board with this. So, you know, even people like Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, is saying, you know, look, if you're not a climate competent board, it's going to be hard for us to invest in you. You've got to demonstrate some kind of social purpose above just making money. Some of the investment houses I've been working with are now launching funds where the sustainable development goals are their investment criteria. And what they're finding is that when they invest in that manner, because they're investing in organizations driven by personal people who are solving real-world problems rather than moving money around, they're getting huge returns on this, you know, getting, you know, returns of 15, 16, 17%. So, you know, again, it's about saying what you want to say in the way people want to hear it. Say, look, purpose-driven companies make more money, have more engaged staff and nicer places to work, and when you tell people what you do for a living at a party on a Friday night, you'll feel justifiably proud. So I think there is this big shift definitely going in that direction. It's going to be generational. You know, I think 30 years from now, we'll look back at sort of the corporate excess of today, and we'll kind of go, wow, you know, that's kind of like it was a disaster. It was a disaster financially, and it was a disaster sort of spiritually, and you know, for everybody. So I think we are getting there. When you see very, very, very big investment houses, as I am doing work with, really beginning to take this on board, that's very hopeful. The problem is that, you know, it's going to take them a long time to change because the status quo is very well embedded. The practices, ways of thinking, mindsets. I think it was Max Planck who said, "Physics advances one funeral at a time." And I think as we move from a sort of an extractive economy to a more purposeful one, you know, it will take quite a few funerals before we get there. But I'm optimistic that we can.
Yeah, interestingly, in terms of your big systems thinking, the original evolution of the corporation, it has happened by little bits and pieces. Like people didn't really understand that originally the corporation was a very limited privilege for a public purpose to be given the benefit of limited liability, and then to focus on shareholder value alone over employees, communities, and the environment was kind of a new thing too. So just telling the story.
And when you focus on only one thing, you know, shareholder value, guess what? It becomes, it's like anybody becomes a sort of a monomaniac. It's just a dysfunctional way of thinking. It's a kind of madness. So I think, you know, we're coming out of that now. And certainly when you're starting to see, you know, new CEOs, you know, getting sort of my age, sort of mid-40s, they're coming in, they've got young children, there's a lot more women in the boardroom, which is great. You know, they've got a different kind of perspective. They've grown up with a different set of sensibilities. I'm not saying, you know, everybody's got this, there's still a whole bunch of, you know, old school thinking out there. But, you know, the world is growing in the end, even for corporations, and those that don't adapt to this will die. The market will do for them eventually, because high sustainability companies that take social justice, gender equality seriously, they just outperform in the long run. They have more loyal staff. They create better products. They reduce their costs because they're thinking more sustainably. It's kind of a virtuous circle.
At this point in time, I would like to invite people to reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit star six on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicebase.org or submit a comment or question via the webcast form. Mark, I have a question for you. Apologize for the reverberation.
Okay.
But hopefully it can come through somehow. You mentioned earlier that sometimes we ignore the big problem. Because it's not convenient to think about it. Because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I imagine part of that discomfort comes from the fact that we don't like to necessarily acknowledge the ways in which we may be contributing to some of the larger problems.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about your thoughts on that, because it seems important in these circles where people are getting together to foster an environment where people can really take a hard look at themselves. And how does that fit in?
Well, I think you do it with kind of generosity. So, the way I do it in my work is by always leading on, you know, all the mistakes or the things I find difficult. You know, so if I'm trying to lead a bunch of people to think about something that they may find uncomfortable, I'll say, here's why it makes me feel uncomfortable. Here's an example of something I did that made me feel uncomfortable. Here's a mistake I made, which was disastrous. It comes back to that comedy training again. You know, comedy that sort of accuses people or laughs at people, and there is a whole bunch of comedy like that, you know, superiority humor, which is all about laughing at the other guy making an idiot of himself. You know, it doesn't teach you anything. It could be funny, you know, seeing somebody fall on their ass is funny maybe for a moment, but you don't learn anything from it. But there is another theory of comedy which is called the emotional release theory. So what you notice is that comedians, very often, very good comedians, will joke about things we find actually emotionally uncomfortable. You know, if you look at their stand-up sets, you know, they'll be talking about the death of a parent or their failures as a lover or the breakup of a relationship or the fact they lost their job or all these really difficult, hard things. And the theory says that the reason we laugh at that is because the comedian somehow dismantled it for us and makes it easy for us to kind of laugh at it. And it's the release of the tension. It's like, oh, actually, you know, I'm feeling that too. And because they're making a joke out of it, I'm kind of released from this. this tension, and that's part of the laughter. So I think it always comes from a position of not trying to ask people, say, you've got to look at this. It's kind of saying, look, this is something I'm looking at. It makes me feel pretty crappy. And then often using a joke at the same time, because it's, you know, once you can release people from that tension, they kind of thank you for it.
Interesting. Thank you.
Interesting. Thank you.
I'm going to open it up now to the Q&A.
Hi, Mark. My name is Gayatri.
Hi.
I'm calling from India. Oh, wow. I was wondering if I was going to
come to you.
I was very struck by this. You said about it's going to take a couple of funerals, because I'm a trained scientist, and we used to say that.
We used to say that.
Got paradigm shifting. I'm curious how you stay optimistic when you know it's going to take a couple of funerals. Because we really don't have that much time for people to die, do we?
We've got
all paradigms
to die.
No.
What are your personal practices to keep this pragmatic optimism flame burning?
It's a great question. I mean, the first is that you have to understand the reality. So I talk a lot in my work about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the bad news is that everything is broken. The good news is that it's all fixable. Most of it's fixable. And the ugly news is it's going to get really messy. I mean, the next 20 or 30 years are kind of a bloodbath, as the old world dies and the new one necessarily has to be born. The optimism comes from saying, well, then I've got something to do. You know, in a time where nothing is changing, then that's actually quite dull. But actually, there's all this amazing opportunity. The whole world is being thrown up in the air, and there's lots of exciting and interesting things to get involved with. And, you know, I guess I'm a guy who likes to be busy, and I like to be busy on things I think are important. I mean, Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, says the best definition of happiness, is find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it. Well, as we enter this, you know, transitional phase, there are so many bigger than me things to get involved with, and for all of us to get involved with, that there's plenty of happiness to go around. So I think it's taking the challenge and going, great, I can be useful, and we've got so many challenges and so many people that need to get involved in solving them that actually, you know, optimism abounds. My friend Ed Gillespie is a futurist I work with in the UK. He says, if you want to subvert the status quo, you have to have more fun than they are, and let them know you're having more fun while you're doing it. And so I also tend to find that it's the people who are changing the world, the people who are the mavericks, the people who are trying new systems of thinking or pioneering new scientific methods, they're generally the people that you kind of want to hang out with. They're generally the people you want to be with at a party. They're people you want to go drinking with. I like to say that, you know, the people who are on the right side of the world, they go to more parties more often, have more sex with more interesting people more regularly. So if that doesn't make you, you know, want to go on the right side of things, I don't know what will. I mean, you know, in India, I covered in the last book, Open Source Drug Discovery, which comes out of Samir Brahmachari's work in Delhi. And, you know, Samir is a massively sort of controversial and radical character, but he's one of the jolliest and happiest people I've ever met in my life. And I think, you know, he's trying to cure tuberculosis and various other things. You know, it's a big old systemic problem, but you know, you'd never meet a happier, jollier, more engaged man.
That's interesting. Because I didn't think you'd reference Kibbe's work. That would be a good description. Of who he is.
Sorry, yeah. Samir, yeah, he's great.
Hello, everyone. I'm very sorry about
these
technical issues.
It
appears to be a systems
issue.
And in light of that, we should probably conclude early. But I'm extremely grateful to all of you and to Mark Stevens
in particular.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
There was some amazing
insights and nuggets throughout the talk. Mark discussed about how he spreads the meme of pragmatic optimism by combating cynicism and our lack of understanding about complex issues. And he talked about how Trump comes about not through throwing a change agenda at people, but through creating spaces for people where they can share their stories and be part of a coherent community. And it also comes about when you say what you want to
say,
but in a way that others
can hear it.
And that requires a lot of skillfulness. And it was wonderful to hear Mark speak to that, and I feel like we got a flavor of that. I really do apologize for the systemic issues in terms of the technical issues here. But I really, really am very grateful for you, Mark, and thank you
for your time.
Yeah, well, it was great to be invited on. Thank you very much for the great questions.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.